Steven Dano. Welcome to this new edition of Spill the Wine. This one's for the cartoon fans. Are there any out there? I'm talking to cartoon genius Joe Sacco. That's right, Joe Sacco. He of such masterworks as Palestine or Footnotes in Gaza. Joe is one of the world's foremost cartoonists and the creator of war reportage comics. He's the author of a number of illustrated books like Palestine, which received the American Book Award. And there's a book called Fixer and another called Save Area Gorazde, in which he reports from the war in Bosnia between 1992 and 95. Joe and I first met when he came to Europe in 1988. He tagged along on a tour of the Portland neo garage band, The Miracle Workers, and he simply stayed and moved in with all of us here in Berlin. I was booking tours for bands. He was drawing the posters for these tours, and I wasn't exactly paying him very well. We had no money. We lived off yogurt and music. But man, those posters, masterpieces. Thin White Rope, 11th Dream Day, Yola Tango, Mudhoney, Soundgarden, Babes in Toyland, Flaming Lips, Cosmic Psychos, they all received the Sacco treatment. Some of these bands did not like these posters at all. They didn't think of themselves as a cartoon band. Then others just loved them. These posters are now collected in a book called But I Like It. Yeah, he's a big, massive Rolling Stones fan. So some people claim that he single-handedly invented the genre of cartoon journalism. He traveled to places that interested him and reported in the form of a graphic novel from those places. Even though this term might be entirely inappropriate because, well, these books are anything but novels, really. His books have won tons of awards and they've been translated into many other languages. I think France is his biggest market, apparently. And when he released a giant fold-out Leporello that depicted in detail the first day of the Battle of the Somme from the First World War, the French even went as far as blowing this piece of art up to a mural stretching over 150 meters in Paris, in Montparnasse. So you could just walk along this giant piece of Joe Sacco art. In our chat, he talks about the gentrification of comics. The what? Yeah, the gentrification of comics. Listen to him explaining how he and his generation of cartoonists, with the arrival of the graphic novel format, became, to quote him, rewarded for doing more mature work, and in the process, they became part of making comics less subversive. This comes from a man who, alongside his peers, redefined alternative comics, I guess alternative to the superhero stuff of Marvel and DC. Folks like Peter Bagg, Dan Klaus, the Hernandez brothers, and Charles Burns, amongst many others, they rewrote comics history in the late 80s and in the 90s. Sacco and his colleagues were a part of an interesting cultural shift of, you know, comics and zines and just independent publishing, entering the alternative or indie cultural landscape around the when the 80s became the 90s. And when grunge happened, and he was out there in the Northwest. So let's hear him talk about it. Here's Joe Sacco and me chatting away. Enjoy. Are you comfortable?
Yeah.
Are you from Malta?
I'm from Malta.
Why are you from Malta?
I don't know. People have been asking this question.
So were you born in Malta?
I was born in Malta.
And didn't you recently go back to Malta?
I did.
Have you been in between?
Yeah.
Between you were born and now?
I had a couple of times where I stayed and lived there.
When was that?
Once in the early 80s for about almost a year and once in 88. Actually, I was in Germany for a bit and then went to Malta and then came back to Germany. I was having a lousy time in Malta the second time. And I was there also to do that story on African migrants landing in Malta. That was about 7 years ago. And then I went to help my mom.
Do you still visit. Have family down there?
tons of people, lots of cousins and aunts and uncles.
And are you in touch with all those people?
Try to see them all. I mean, that's what was kind of difficult about this trip.
Oh, too many people to see.
Too many people to see. So it was like, you know, in one day you're going to three different houses and seeing three different sets of people and saying the same thing over and over again. I mean, I like seeing my relatives. I like it.
So you were born in Malta, and then how long did you live down there?
I was about a year old when we immigrated.
Right. And you moved to Australia?
Yep. Moved to Australia.
But you were a baby.
I was a baby, so obviously I don't remember that. I don't remember
what
that.
Did your father do?
Engineer. He was an engineer. And there were a couple of reasons we moved, but one of the main ones was my parents were worried about the influence of the Catholic Church upon what it would be upon us, because they'd had problems with the church. As far as you know, there's a lot of nepotism in Malta, but there's also in villages, the parish priest, the priest would sort of was able to direct who was going to go where and who would be favored. And I mean, that doesn't really exist in that way anymore in Malta, but at that time it still did. And that's one of the reasons we left.
Oh, okay. So what happened in Australia? How long did you live in Australia then?
About 10 years. I grew up there. My dad was an engineer. My mother was a school teacher there. And I went to school and, you know, I had a great time in Australia. I was happy in Australia.
Did you pick up the accent a bit?
I did pick up the accent. That's where I learned to speak was in Australia. Right. So I picked it up a bit, but I divested myself of the accent once I came to America and so many people made fun of me.
So from there, you moved where?
Moved to Los Angeles on my dad's student visa. So he was accepted into a school to study aircraft maintenance in Los Angeles, and that's where we moved to.
How old was he when he was a student? And
In his early 40s.
Oh, wow.
He was in his early 40s, but my dad was studying until the very end. I mean, he learned how to type when he was in his 70s.
Wow.
And he was always studying something. I mean, he was kind of a real inspiration to me in that way. I mean, always with a book, always with a piece of paper and a pencil, and he would take notes. He was always studying something.
So was he a political guy?
He was quite political. That's another part of the story in Malta for him. He was part of the socialist, the Labour Party, it was called. And they were real socialists. And he would open labor like meetings and things like that. He was quite involved. And he always sort of remained a socialist to the end, but he would go in and out of sort of this cynical way of thinking about the world and then back to his socialist ways of thinking about the world. So he was kind of a mixture of a lot of different ideas they were contradictory and often didn't make sense when you put them together.
Mm-hmm. And they stayed near LA, didn't they? Your parents?
They did.
And then you?
I mean, it's a convoluted story, but we actually moved up to Portland, Oregon. Then they moved back.
Oh.
My dad lost a job in Portland and then ended up, I mean, to make a long story short, ended up back in the LA area,
mm-hmm.
in Ventura County. And he was working on the space shuttle. That was his last sort of career move, was a, he was a test engineer,
your
design
dad
engineer.
Was a rocket scientist.
He was, I wouldn't call him a rocket scientist, but, I don't think he would call himself that, but, he was involved in test engineering and design of rockets, actually.
Interesting.
Yeah, I guess he was a rocket scientist.
Right. Yeah.
He had a very interesting career. I mean, my dad's intellectual life and just the way his everything played out for him is kind of amazing to me.
Hmm. Interesting. So when did you pick up the cartoon stencil?
That was in Australia.
That early? Like, so
when I was about six,
oh, wow.
or seven, I started drawing, and my sister and I started drawing, and we both ripped off the same cartoon character from some English magazine, this character called Moonbeam. And then we would argue over who stole it first.
So this is early 70s, or maybe the change
mid,
of 60,
late
60s to
mid,
70s.
Mid to late 60s.
Right.
So I was drawing that whole time, and that just carried over.
And when was the heyday of this sort of underground comics and R. Crumb and all that? Wasn't that
was
the 70s, right?
Late 60s, early to mid 70s.
So did you, was that, did, did, Did you notice all that? Was that?
No, not at all. No. I mean, I was nowhere near that sort of thing. I mean, okay. Growing up in Australia, the only thing I read that was, like Mad Magazine was somehow part of the culture of America, but underground comics I didn't see till I was in my late teens.
Mm. And when did you get serious about that? The whole
comics?
Yeah.
I think I was always really serious about it, but I never really thought of it as a way of making a living. I mean, that really did not enter into my mind. It was only after, I mean, what I wanted to do was study journalism.
Well, it took a while to make a living of it too.
It took a long time to make a living at drawing. You were part of that because I was in Berlin for quite a while, drawing rock posters and all that sort of thing. I mean, basically I tried to make a living at journalism, like being a straight news reporter, and there were just no jobs like that. And there were a lot of lousy. Can I say shitty on this?
You can say anything.
All right. There were a lot of shitty journalism jobs, and I had some of them. Yeah. And it was so disappointing. It's just not the reason I went into journalism school.
Mm-hmm.
I went to journalism school because I actually wanted to engage with interesting people and ideas. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't happening. I mean, most journalism in America is about engaging with advertisers and making sure that products sell through the paper.
Very much to this date.
To this day, it has always been thus. So, I was very disappointed with the kind of jobs I found. And then I basically fell back on drawing or cartooning just because I did not like the way my life was going.
Right. So how did the career actually start? I mean, when was the first thing published?
Well, I mean, aside from some things in some school newspapers and some odds and ends, basically I'd say my first real foray into comics was when I was working at Fantagraphics back down in LA when I was in my mid-20s, perhaps. And
weren't they a Seattle company?
They are in Seattle now, but in those days they were, just coincidentally, they were right basically 5 miles from where my parents lived. Huh. In those days they were in Agoura Hills. So
this is when now?
This is in the mid-80s.
Okay.
And I started doing like small, you know, 2-3-page stories. And building up from there, I'd worked on some really ambitious projects before that, but they were failures, let's say,
right,
to put it politely. And really long projects. And I realized I just have to learn how to do a 2-page story, a 1-page story.
Mm-hmm.
And I did more or less. And then I put together a number of comics to sort of self-publish. In those days, a lot of cartoonists were self-publishing, and I scraped together a couple of $1,000. And I was going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I passed it by Kim Thompson, who was one of the publishers at Fantagraphics. And he said, we'll publish it, which surprised me. I was just passing it by him to see what he thought of it, mm-hmm. more or less. And so that's when things happen.
They had
for me.
Compilation magazines with.
They did. And that's what I was contributing to before that. But now I sort of had my own comic. And the second issue was sort of a journalistic piece on some level, because that's when I came to Europe with the band The Miracle Workers as a roadie, basically selling T-shirts, but, you know, drawing the band in operation. They were hilarious, you know. They were just like a real interesting group of people to be with.
And you made them even more hilarious.
I made them more hilarious. I did not invent their words. So they were just naturally a hilarious band with groupies and the whole thing. And that's when I basically met you and you and Camille Lemons, mm-hmm. when you had your tour agency, you guys asked me to do rock posters. So that.
Well, you were just freewheeling and stuck around. You were like, I'm going to stay here in Berlin.
Well, you asked me, you said, if you want to come back to Berlin, come back. And I sort of listened to that and came and, I started doing some posters for you, as you remember,
the yogurt years
for the price of yogurt and I think 25 marks.
That seems high.
I feel I was ripped off, and one day there'll be an accounting for it. But
you got to keep all the original art, and you can now sell that off for tens of thousands of dollars, no?
If I can figure out how to do it, I probably would. But, yeah, I mean, that was kind of the start. It wasn't like doing comics. I was working on comics, but really I was sort of making my living, doing rock art. I mean, and in Berlin in those days, it didn't take much to make a living. And as you know, I was kind of living on people's couches.
Yeah.
And when I eventually came back a year or two later to actually stay in Berlin for a couple of years, you know, I was bouncing from one apartment to another, paying rent. But I mean, Berlin was never that expensive at that time.
No, you had like 9 plastic bags and that was your belongings.
Those are my belongings. Yeah. And every now and then you would help me transfer to my new abode. Yeah.
I did think, didn't you stay with me for a long time?
I stayed.
The liner notes days.
The liner notes days. I mean, I stayed. You were with Gudrun, your girlfriend at the time, now your wife, and you would be in her apartment and I would stay in yours.
Yeah.
And another times I would stay, I think it was Gudrun's apartment and you were elsewhere. I can't remember how exactly
I went
it
on tour
out.
A lot at that time.
Yeah. So I was on my own. I like those. Those were good times. I mean,
good lean times. So the magazine that you put out, it was
called Yahoo.
Yahoo. And, way before Yahoo, the media.
Right.
Those were pretty thin little affairs, right?
Well, in those days, the so-called graphic novel wasn't really a thing.
Yeah, I was going to.
I mean, all cartoonists, all we fantasized about was having our own 24 or 32 page mm-hmm. comic, which we would try to turn out. I mean, the goal was like usually every 3 months, but it usually ended up being every 6 months. And that was kind of the height of what we thought life would lead to. And we were very satisfied with that.
Yeah, things, people had these series. Peter Bagg, I remember.
Peter Bagg.
What was it called? Hate.
Hate. Yeah. He had Neat Stuff First, then Hate. Dan yeah. Klaus had Lloyd Llewellyn, then 8-Ball. Chris Ware was coming out with his stuff. Julie Doucet, mm-hmm. who also lived in Berlin. And I mean, everyone had these little.
She
lived in Berlin at the same time I did. I only met her once there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so.
We met her in Portugal.
Yeah, in Portugal too. Yeah. That's right.
So when did the arrival of the format, the graphic novel, is that the savior for cartoon and comics culture to a degree?
I think it's a whole new income thing.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, obviously when you're 30 years old and you're doing these little now they call them floppies, but those comics, that was kind of, you know, like I said, the height of our existence, but it probably wouldn't have been a living.
Mm-hmm.
Few people were able to make a living at it. Someone like Peter Bagg probably did, because he sold 20,000 or 25,000 copies. But I was selling 3,000, 4,000. Right. That was not a living. Eventually, the comics collected into books that were then eventually sold through bookstores is what made it possible to make a proper living.
Mm-hmm.
Because comics that I was doing, eventually I started doing political work, would never have made it in the ordinary sort of comic book store where no. most people are going in to buy superhero stuff like Batman and all that stuff. So basically, the books is where we all began to start to make a living. But the interesting thing about books is they also began to sort of gentrify comics.
In what way?
Well, in the sense that a lot of us really came, the undergrounds were kind of our forebearers,
mm-hmm.
and that's what influenced us. Most of us were doing sort of nastier work with an underground aesthetic because it sort of didn't matter in a way. There was nowhere you were going to go. Once books happened, the possibilities opened up. You know, we thought we could reach a book audience, which was a different kind of audience altogether.
Mm-hmm.
And so as we matured, our work became more mature. We were rewarded for doing more mature work. And that slowly, we became part of making comics less subversive. Making a living made them less subversive for the most part. Not entirely, but for the most part.
So when you say we, who were you?
I'm talking about in those days, let's say there were probably 24 North American cartoonists that I would say were my peers and we're all at about the same level. Now there's probably a couple of hundred, 300.
So it's become a real thing.
It's become a real thing. But in those days, everyone knew each other. We all knew each other's work and we all knew each other personally.
And
we still do.
And you went to conventions and whatnot.
We went to conventions and we saw each other there, you know, at those places and we made those tight connections. And we still, I'd say most of us are pretty tight with each other still. that second generation after the underground cartoonists.
Did you ever meet any of the first generation?
Yeah, I've met them over the years. You know, people like Spain, Robert Crumb, mm-hmm. Dennis Kitchen.
What do they make of you guys?
I think they think us as legitimate heirs to their work. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were all really influenced by them. We all made sure that they knew that we really appreciated what they did, and we let them know that we were influenced and that it showed in our work. I mean, my work obviously is influenced by the undergrounds, in particular Robert Crumb.
So when you, that was all funnies, Yahoo, that was pretty humor stuff, no?
The thing that was different about Yahoo, you know, people like Peter Bagg were doing comics where they had a set group of characters.
Yeah.
And they were in like situations almost like sitcoms where there would be a story, it would sort of end with the same characters.
Well, there was also Love and Rockets.
Right? Yes. Yeah, really huge. Yeah. But with Yahoo, what I wanted to do was sort of experiment. So I did some funny stuff. I did journalism. I did the story of my mother in World War II. There was some serious stuff there. There was autobiographical stuff. I was doing other people's stories and then just, you know, straight satire. Mm-hmm. And I was, in a way, I was trying to find my own voice, but I liked it. I liked changing things up. I think it was really good for me. And then, of course, then I started doing that series called Palestine, which is probably what, you know, it didn't feel like it at the time. At the time, it felt like it was commercial suicide, but that's what ended up making, let's say, a career for me.
Yeah.
And,
was that a series first?
It was a series at first.
It was a series of floppy
24-32 page comics. Huh. And each selling less than the one before it.
So when did you go down to Palestine and Israel the first time?
It was the winter of 1991-1992. I mean, I was living in Berlin at the time. Mm-hmm. And I was always really interested in the subject. And living in Europe had really sort of given me a more nuanced idea of what was going on. Because in America, you're really pretty much fed an Israeli version of events. So living in Europe, doing some reading, all that stuff contributed to looking at it a bit more nuanced, in a bit more nuanced way. So, I went there, for a couple of months. I think it was a couple of months and collected information. And I honestly didn't really know what I was doing. I just knew I'll do a series of comics about my trip there. And it was kind of a natural progression from doing autobiographical work to basically thinking I'll talk about my own experiences there. Mm-hmm. But when I was there, it's like this, this journalistic thing just kicked into high gear because that's what I'd studied. So suddenly I realized I started behaving like a journalist. I mean, it wasn't a question of just getting the story from someone. You realize, oh, well, I found that story, but I need other pieces to put this jigsaw puzzle together. And you sort of know what they are. You think, oh, well, I need to talk to someone who had his house demolished. Mm. I need to speak to someone who's been imprisoned. Not hard to do over there.
Yeah.
And so little by little, you begin to build up what the occupation looks like. And so I came back with all that information and started doing that series of comics.
And then technically, did you take pictures?
I took pictures. I seldom sketched.
Yeah.
It took time to sketch. A lot of cartoonists I know who do journalism, they sketch, and it helps them meet people that way. But I find that when I'm in a situation like that, I really want to talk to people. I really want to get into their stories. Mm-hmm. And I'll ask them, you know, visual questions like describe what something looked like. That's what I need for drawing. And then I took a lot of photographs for reference.
And was the first Gulf War still raging on when you went down there for the first time?
It was.
What was it at the end of it?
It was the 1 year anniversary of the first Gulf War.
Okay.
So, it was still a rather recent event. Mm. And yeah, I spent a couple of months, came back, did the comics, and that took about 3.5-4 years to do. I came back, moved back to America.
Wow.
In the middle of it.
3.5-4 years.
Yeah. And like I say, they didn't sell very well at all.
What were you living off? What did you do for a living?
Well, I mean, in those days, this is what was great about living in a city where you can actually pay the rent mm-hmm. easily. It allows you to do that sort of work. I mean, it didn't cost a lot of money to live in Portland and to pay the rent. So I would often stop what I was doing to work on things for Harvey Pekar, for example, who was a writer right. who had sort of partnered with cartoonists, including Robert Crumb, who called me up out of the blue and basically eventually said, do you want to do some work for me? So every month we would do something for the Village Voice, and that was like $500. He'd give me the lion's share of that work. You helped me out because do you remember this Swiss comic? The Swiss comic I would do this for Agenda. I think the name of the magazine was Agenda. They'd give me a pretty good amount of money, and it was in German. You would translate all that stuff into German.
Oh, wow.
You remember that? I mean, that was actually a significant amount of my, and you did it for nothing. And that was a sort of a significant.
I felt I owed you for the rock, for the rock posters.
And you did. But that was a significant amount of money. And so I was basically cobbling together a living while I was working on the Palestine book. The Palestine book, I would turn in an issue and get $500.
Mm-hmm.
That's for, you know,
wow.
3 to 5 months' work.
Jesus.
I mean, there were times where I was actually quite poor. I mean, I didn't know.
Yeah.
I didn't know how I was going to get through the week, but managed to. I mean, when you're a certain age, you can sort of roll with things in a different way.
Yeah, we all did.
Yeah. So we all know that thing. And, yeah, that's.
So when was that compiled into a book?
Finally. That was compiled into a book. Interestingly, after my book on Bosnia came out.
Oh, that's right. Then you went to the former Yugoslavia.
Yeah, I went through the former Yugoslavia. That's right.
There was a bulletproof vest.
Oh yeah, that was kind of a funny story. I mean, I went back to Berlin because I was working with a German cartoonist named Hansi Kiefersauer,
right.
And he paid me quite a lot of money to do backgrounds for his comic strip. So I was saving up some money to go to Bosnia.
What's backgrounds for his comic strip?
It means he hated filling in the black areas. He just put a little X where a black area had to be filled in. And I would just sit there with a pen, just putting in blacks. Or he would, he showed me how to draw like a beach the way he likes to draw it. So he would draw the characters and he would have me draw the beach, for example. That's the backgrounds.
Is that a common thing amongst a successful comic?
It's not that common, but he had so much work that he needed to sort of cut down on those sorts of things that just took up time. And that he didn't particularly enjoy doing. And to me, it was like, okay, I'll do this for that kind of money. It was good money.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Okay.
So I went down to Bosnia and I didn't really know how to get to Sarajevo. And those, I mean, it was under siege and it was very difficult to get in. And I was just hanging around. And finally someone said, well, I think it was some Danish organization for 2 weeks is going to be going through and they will take journalists, but you need a flak jacket. An armored vest.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have one. I didn't have the money for one. Over there, they were going for like $1,000. And that pretty much was half of the money I'd saved up. And so I don't know if you remember this exactly, but I basically called you up from Croatia and said, I need this. Can you please special order it? Send it to Munich. And you did this. It cost a lot of money. You paid out of your pocket. I paid you back eventually, but
You owe me.
I paid you back, damn it.
Did you?
Yeah.
Just in general, I think you owe me.
I think you owe me. but it was special ordered. You send it to our mutual friend, Ruth, in Munich.
Mm-hmm.
And I took the train back to Munich, picked it up, came back.
Wow.
And then got on this van, and there was a woman in an evening dress on this van without a flak jacket. And I thought, what the hell? Uh-huh. I didn't even wear it. I never wore that thing once.
We still have it.
Do you still have it?
I think it's still somewhere around the house.
Really? That stuff degrades. Yeah. You can probably throw it out at this point. It's Kevlar.
I'm holding on to it for you. So what was the idea? What compelled you to go down there in the first place?
Well, I mean, being a European, it was kind of shocking that was going on.
We had a war right in front of our house.
Yeah.
In front of our door.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
And I guess I was sort of, I mean, I was compelled, like a lot of Westerners were compelled, this sort of story of Sarajevo, a multicultural city being attacked by ethnic nationalists. And that was an interesting story to me. And it made me really think, wow, this is going to happen in Europe again, you know, like what had happened in World War II. And I was kind of shocked by it. And I got to Sarajevo, and of course the story is way more complicated by this, you know, multi-ethnic city. It was very complicated. And
the atrocities that were going on down there were just...
Oh, they were horrendous. I mean, yeah. I got there maybe a month and a half, 2 months after the massacre at Srebrenica.
Mm.
We all knew something was up, but we weren't 100% sure of what had happened. Eventually, I met people who had escaped from Srebrenica when I was in Garajda, which was another of the so-called safe areas. But basically, I got to Sarajevo. I was following a number of different people and a number of different stories. But I felt like the whole place was overcooked and they were really tired of seeing foreign journalists. I was sort of okay because I was a cartoonist.
But they didn't know that.
They did know that. Yeah. I mean, I was hanging out with young people in these rock clubs. I was in my mid-30s and those guys were, you know, 10 years younger than me. Yeah. Not that, you know, we were all around the same age listening to the same music. And I got to know those people, but actually, I went to this place called Garajda, this place in eastern Bosnia, which had just opened up to convoys, UN convoys. It had been under siege for the whole war.
Mm-hmm.
And I just got on, just to see it, you know, just got on one of the convoys with my press pass. And I just fell in love with the place. I mean, people were so friendly. They were so happy to see anyone from the outside. Because it basically meant the outside world existed.
Right. And cared.
And cared. And other journalists were going and spending a few hours and then coming back with the returning convoy. And I just basically made a habit of just staying until I could get on, you know, a convoy when I wanted to get on a convoy. So I went there 4 times. Longest time I spent there was maybe 2 weeks.
Didn't you also, that was your first time meeting other sort of war correspondents, right?
In Bosnia, yeah. I mean, I met other correspondents in Jerusalem, but I was so unsure of what I was doing that but I never
this,
really.
But not this type of professional.
Oh, absolutely professional. Absolute war correspondent in the true sense of the word. I mean, you know, you meet these radio journalists and everyone has to make a living, right? So basically an experienced radio journalist would listen to another radio journalist and say, you know, you could have turned that into 6 stories, and 6 stories is 6 times the amount of money. Like, he'd listen to you one story and say, you could have broken that up.
Right.
And so people, I mean, you end up monetizing your trade.
Yeah.
It's part of what has to happen in a way, but it was also sort of interesting seeing that attitude, how journalists have to make a living, especially freelancers.
Right.
But it was interesting. I mean, I met a lot of compelling people there. Chris Hedges, who became a good friend, friend.
And you later made a book together.
Yeah, we made a book together. So it was a good experience being in Bosnia. I mean, I really learned a lot. I was much more focused than I had been in Palestine, where I was kind of, you know, really trying to find my own feet journalistically.
Mm-hmm.
But in Bosnia, I knew what I was doing.
And that, how many books came out of that? I mean, The Fixer,
Safe Area Garajda. There were a couple of short stories. One was called Christmas with Karadzic.
Mm-hmm.
He was an indicted war criminal. And I was with a couple of journalists. We just decided to try to find him, and we did. and a short story called Shoba of about 40-some pages, just following a guy, his story. Mm-hmm. He was kind of a rocker. who his night job was with the army and looking for enemy mines, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just like a story of one individual.
So when you started putting these books, so then those turned into graphic novels right away.
I mean, the Garajda book went straight to graphic novel. It skipped the whole comic book phase.
Mm-hmm.
By that point, things were coming out as graphic novels pretty regularly. And that just seemed the right way to approach it, because it would be in a bookstore, and Fantagraphics, which was putting it out, had a distribution deal. All those business deals were really important. They were all going on at that time. There were a lot of false starts. There was a lot of sort of skepticism about it. A lot of young people trying to figure out how to get involved in the book trade. A lot of people smacking them down, but eventually realizing that it was the right way to go.
Mm-hmm. And did they fall on fruitful ground right away, or did it take some time to? Did I mean
that
this,
did
this whole genre of cartoon journalism? You kind of started that, didn't you? Or were there other people where you said, "Nah, I'd say that person did that"? Or
Well, I mean, it has such a long history, actually.
It
comes out of the 1800s when the London Illustrated News would send out illustrators to follow military campaigns. And Harper's Magazine in America was sending artists to draw Civil War battles. So, I mean, it has a sort of a history. I didn't really know the history. Mm-hmm. I wasn't even sure what I was doing. I just sort of studied journalism and was a cartoonist. So the two things naturally went together. The book on Garage, that to my surprise hit it off. It got reviewed in the New York Times, the Sunday New York Times, mm-hmm. which was sort of a big deal. And suddenly everyone was interested, because once the New York Times looks at something, everyone looks at it. It's kind mm-hmm. of monkey see, monkey do. Mm-hmm. And that's what really launched. It was that review that really launched things for me. And then the Palestine book, which had done so poorly as a comic, as a series of comics, was put together as a book. Mm-hmm. And suddenly that did really well. It's still my best-selling book.
Huh. And that's a hot topic. Did you get a lot of sort of flack from Israeli
surprisingly media? Not. No, because basically what happened is it sold so poorly as a comic book. Mm-hmm. It was so under the radar that no one paid attention. Why draw attention to something that is selling so poorly anyway? Right? So no one paid attention, and that was good because I was able to really sort of find my way without people barking in my ear.
Right.
And, sort of develop self-confidence without a lot of undue criticism. I mean, you know, pretty much where there's been some pushback is usually in local stores where they won't take it. Mm. They won't sell it because customers will complain. They'll call it anti-Semitic or something like that.
So you did these books, and then you started, you got invited to universities a bunch then, didn't you? Did that start around that time when you just?
That started around then, because a lot of universities to this day, it's kind of how I make a lot of my living is,
So that pays. It's not just like, oh yeah, I'll go there and speak. You get paid for that.
Yeah, usually. I mean, it depends how much. And sometimes I'll go, if I want to meet a particular professor because I'm interested in a book they wrote, mm-hmm. I might take less or even take nothing. But generally it pays. But what actually really helps is that my book is used in a lot of classes. Two or three of my books are used in a lot of classes, like journalism classes, Middle East classes, comparative lit classes.
Okay.
So that was not something I thought was ever – I mean, that didn't even occur to me that could happen, but it has, and it's helped me out.
And you're always in these books. You sort of draw yourself into these situations, unless you're reporting about some historic event. You show yourself with blinded glasses. You're like this, why?
Well, I mean, why I'm in the books is because...
No, I mean,
why the blinded glasses?
Yeah, why do you show yourself like this little...
The eyes are the window to the soul.
The humbled. Okay.
And I mean, basically... I want to show myself truthfully, but I don't want to show my entire emotional way of looking at it. And I want to disguise some of my own feelings about what I'm seeing. Mm. That was the impetus to doing it. Now it just seems like a pretense, I have to say. I don't even think about it anymore. That's just my character, and that's the way I draw myself.
Yeah.
But drawing myself in my work really is an outgrowth of autobiographical comics. Like I told you, I was interested in doing... I thought I would do stories of my experiences in the Middle East. So mm-hmm. drawing myself in my comics came out of autobiography. But then I realized as they became more journalistic, to me it was helpful because it showed that this is really seeing a story through an individual's eyes. I don't pretend neutrality. I don't pretend objectivity. Mm. So I realized it has an added benefit of really making that clear to the reader that this is a subjective look at this particular story.
So what did you do after all that? So you had Palestine out, you had the Bosnian War books out.
I did my biggest book in terms of just sheer number of pages, Footnotes in Gaza. I went back to Gaza and I did sort of a historical work mixed with journalism, looking at two large massacres of Palestinians by the Israeli army during the Suez Canal crisis. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting to me because these are the biggest massacres on Palestinian soil of Palestinians. And there's almost nothing about them. Just some reference in a UN document.
Well, they don't have a media lobby. I mean,
they don't have a media lobby or anything like that. Yeah. But I was surprised that not even historians had really tried to research it, because that is a issue. The Palestinian Israeli conflict is a subject that has been gone over almost with a fine tooth comb by many historians. It was a surprise to me that no one had really gotten into this.
Mm-hmm.
And I, in a previous trip to Gaza, with Chris Hedges doing a magazine piece, we asked around about this massacre, and we met all these older people that remembered it. And I thought, well, I should do a book about this. So I went back and just found old people to talk to.
And that book is a monster. I mean, how long did it take you to do that?
It took about 7 years. Jeez. I mean, I took some time to do other stories. I did shorter pieces. I went to Iraq, did a few stories about Iraq, went to Ingushetia to do stories about Chechen refugees, went to Malta to do a story about African migrants, did these shorter pieces that were eventually collected too. But during that process, I worked on footnotes in Gaza. And overall, it probably was about 5 years worth of work.
Wow.
Pretty long book.
What, you seem to go where misery is stacked up for you to a degree.
Yeah, maybe that's true.
I remember when we were driving to Austria or something, and you're like, come on, let's go to Yugoslavia. I can hear the tanks from here.
I think partly it's because, I mean, you're from Europe, right? You're from Europe. Europe. And you grew up with these stories about the war, and hearing my parents relate everything that happened to them, the idea of war as being part of someone's life it wasn't like something that could never happen. Now in America, most people are not familiar with war. They can't really imagine it. But the thing is, you learn about you go to the Middle East, you find out about the Palestinians, and you do a book, and then you realize how much deeper you could go into that subject. So you do another book. The same about Bosnia. I mean, you go, you find out something. And as you go, you begin to understand how things work. I'm very interested in how humanity works, and human nature is really important to me. But I have to say, drawing that book about footnotes in Gaza, I got really fed up doing it. And I actually decided I would swear off doing journalism, which I haven't done. Mm-hmm. I haven't sworn it off, but I'm sort of going in different directions now. So I'm working on a book now. It's sort of in the queue, even though I've done all the research. I've actually gone to the place and all that. I'm doing a book about a riot in India between Muslims and Hindus. I mean, this conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And though obviously you have to get down to the facts of what happened, I'm more interested in what people tell themselves about something that happened a year ago, how they reconcile just living life with a massacre that happened in their village, if they even acknowledge that it happened. And so that's sort of how I'm looking at that story and how crowds work.
Mm-hmm.
That's, to me, is very interesting. And it's not just about India. To me, it has consequences in a place like America under Trump. How do crowds work? How does he get a crowd just to sort of be on the cusp of violence? That's interesting to me. So like human psychology, you know, is another door that opened up when you're exploring these issues. So when you ask a question like, how come you keep going back? It's because you're trying to get to something. You're trying to understand really what goes on, how people can do that to each other.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like a compulsion now to try to figure that out.
And have you figured it out?
I think I'll never get exactly there, but I'm learning a lot.
Do you still believe in humanity?
Of course, you know, I meet really good people. I've met really good people everywhere I've gone. I've met good people who will say the most outrageously awful things. These mixtures, these contradictions, these paradoxes are really interesting to me too. Mm. I've met people who give me the shirt off their back, but they are completely propagandized and cannot sort of see beyond what the powers that be are telling them. I think people don't want to think the worst of their brothers and their fathers, and so they will They will subscribe to whatever explanation makes it easier to swallow whatever has happened.
Hmm.
And I've noticed that. I mean, I did another story about Srebrenica. I did it a few years ago, 2013. And I spent time with Serbs sort of talking to them. And to this day, most of them will not acknowledge, even Serbs from Srebrenica will not acknowledge what's happened there.
And why is that? What do you think that is? Is that just a tendency of human nature?
I think so. I think it's really hard to admit what your people have done. I mean, actually, Germany might be one of the only societies that has tried hard to come to terms with what happened.
It took forever to get to that point.
It took forever, maybe. It
took a couple of generations.
A couple of generations. A lot of things were swept under the rug. But
and now
really,
we live with this eternal guilt. No, I mean, it is. It's so present.
It's so present, but I mean... But I appreciate that about the Germans. I can't say I would like to be a German and have to live with that sort of thing, because I think it would be very difficult.
Well, I think it's very important that it's alive.
I think it's important that it's alive too. But then you have cultures like Japan that committed a lot of atrocities in China, Americans who committed a lot of atrocities in Vietnam, mm-hmm. often not really coming to terms with them properly. Look what we've done in Iraq and all over the place. I mean, we're giving weapons to the Saudis who are dropping them in Yemen, and no one even talks about it.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you don't want to keep confronting yourself with the truth about your society and the people around you. I mean, that's not – people cannot – evolutionarily, I think it's very difficult to really comprehend and imbibe what is going on in this world and, of course, what is going on – what is being perpetrated by your side.
But yet you confront yourself with the deepest of miseries where, you know, in most of your...
The Human Misery Project.
Yeah, that's you. That's your work.
But, you I've tried to... I've actually tried to get away from it. I'm doing stories about Indigenous people in Canada. Mm-hmm. And then I realized the sort of... There's violence by guns. That sort of cutting the people's throats, lining them up against a wall and shooting them. There's that. Mm-hmm. Then there's violence by education. When you realize, you know, I went there thinking I'm going to do a story about Indigenous people and resource extraction, how that works, how they feel about it. It ends up being really about the residential school system, which pulled Indigenous people away from their families. And if the parents didn't let it happen, they would take away their traps. And that's how they used to trap fur animals mm-hmm. to trade. Or put them in jail. They'd take their kids. They'd fly them to different places. They would punish children for speaking their own language. They had to learn English.
When
they could not. This is from the mid 1800s to 1996.
Jesus.
There was a big Truth and Reconciliation Committee in Canada, but these people lived under. They basically were not allowed to speak their language. Returned to their communities. Later on when they were older teenagers mm-hmm. and probably couldn't even speak to their grandparents anymore. They were cut from their culture
mm-hmm.
and it was really purposeful and they were made Christians. Do you know what I mean? I mean, it was really beaten into them, right. Literally beaten into them. So there's another form of violence. You sort of can't get away from violence.
I guess not.
Versions of violence, let's say.
So when did you turn, when did you, so you did all this reporting all over the world, but you know, then at some point you turned to domestic issues here. How did that come about?
That came about because I was, sitting with Chris Hedges having a drink. We're old pals. He was a New York Times correspondent for a long time, but then had broken off and had written some books and done quite well. But we just were looking around us thinking this country's going to hell. There are a lot of people who are really suffering. I mean, you don't know it when you live in a place like Portland. Well, now you do know it because there are so many homeless people in Portland.
Yeah.
But what's going on in the middle parts of the country is very different from what's going on in the coasts. The wealth is in the coasts. Education is in the coasts for the most part.
Yeah.
So we decided we would go to four different geographical areas and look at four basically different ethnic groups. Native Americans, Hispanics, African Americans and white people.
Mm-hmm.
And all of them in their own way are sort of being screwed in some ways, these various communities.
By
hollowed out cities where, you know, Camden, New Jersey, which was full of industry, and then the industry pulled out and just left sort of a husk, and, you know, everything just collapsed there mm-hmm. because of that. In the same basically true in West Virginia, where there had been this coal industry, and eventually that all sort of ended, and people were worked to death in the mines, and really, I mean, have a strong work ethic, and now there are no jobs at all. There's no place to get fresh vegetables. You have to drive 45 minutes to get a fresh vegetable, and just living in real poverty, people being exploited, illegal and legal migrants being exploited in Florida,
mm-hmm.
Terribly. And then the Pine Ridge Reservation, where Native Americans have just, I mean, it's like the defeat of Wounded Knee, which happened in the late 1800s. It's like it happened yesterday, because people are still living defeat
right.
somehow. And how people are struggling against that, trying to pick themselves up, but just how, you know, we don't think about that. And it in some ways, it's no surprise that someone like Trump won. You know, when you see that sort of thing, when you see how...
Okay, wait, go, this book
oh, yes.
that you're describing.
Well, I mean, in a way, it's partly a... It's almost like an explanation for how things might play yes. out. But basically, Chris did most of the writing for it,
mm-hmm.
and I did drawing. We did our reporting together.
Right. It's called...
It's called Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. It right. ends at Zuccotti Park during the Occupy movement.
Right, and it ends almost on a bit of a hopeful...
On an optimistic note.
On an optimistic right. note. So where did that all go?
Well, it depends how you look at it. I mean, it depends on what day it is, but some days I feel like, well, they could have got it together if they hadn't been so caught up in process itself. Like, how do we hear each other? It became very much about
the Occupy process, movement.
Occupy movement.
Yeah.
But I would say a lot of good things came out of Occupy, because that was really the first time. I'd say overall it was really helpful. It was the first time that people started really dealing and talking about inequality.
Mm-hmm.
That became a word that was being used a lot. And really, I cannot imagine Bernie Sanders really existing without Occupy building some sort of framework for talking about certain things. And also, there have been people who came out of Occupy who've run for city council and have gotten the wages up in local places, in municipalities and in states, up to $15 an hour, which isn't very much at all. You really can't live on $15 an hour,
no.
but it's better than $10 an hour. And a lot of those, some of those people came out of Occupy. So a lot of thoughts were percolating because of Occupy. It's like a lot of things. I mean, something happens, it sort of fails in one sense, but it inspires people in another. You build on the ashes in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe in a lot of ways that's a good thing. There was maybe more hope in that book than Chris and I are usually allow ourselves, I think.
Well, that book blew my mind. That book is amazing. I read it and I thought people should read this in school. People should, you know, I mean, of course, his part is a polemic and he's raging on. But when you read through all, when you go through these wastelands and you just, the poverty and all what you describe there, I would probably, you know, I mean, that just, I would rage, you know.
You would rage.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the reasons people voted for Obama is because he had that message of hope. Now, whether he delivered, of course, is another story altogether. But even Trump, in his own way, his own brutal way, was also saying, I could do things differently. It seems that people want to believe that they can somehow, they will be pulled up. Mm. If they were disappointed by Obama, nothing really changed for them under Obama. And of course, nothing's going to change for them under Trump.
Right. So what's going to happen?
I don't know, but there's
an uprising.
It could get to that. I mean, when you see how, now whether it will be sort of a coherent uprising is another story altogether. I'm not sure I really believe that we're anywhere near that stage.
No, I think the distractions are way too big.
Distractions are big, but I do see pushbacks on local levels. It's going to have to happen because this new budget, this new tax bill, the tax bill that the Republicans are about to pass is going to decrease corporate taxation to even greater level. And to balance budgets or to bring budget under control, they're going to have to cut something. There's no way they're going to cut the military. That keeps getting expanded. Their next stop is all any social services that America has. And there are very few compared to Europe. Any social safety net is going to be cut further and further and further. And at some point, people will push back. Like I say, it might be really incoherent. This isn't a country that I can imagine being on the streets like they are in France in that sort of way. But let's see. Let's see what's going to happen.
Maybe when the opiates are cut.
People need to medicate. You know, that was the big lesson to me is everywhere you go, people are self-medicating.
Yeah. You turn on the TV and they tell you in those commercial breaks, it's cool. It's okay that you have a pain. We have something for you. You know, if you're in pain, it's all right.
Yeah. Painkillers, opiates.
So this is just
alcohol. We all do it to some extent. We all imbibe for reasons, but, you're in places where that's the only way to sort of get through life. And that's pretty sad. This country always talks about its exceptionalism, and it's really actually a cruel country. It's cruel to its own people. It's cruel to others, but it's really cruel internally. And at some point, people are going to realize that this story they keep getting about how exceptional they are because they're Americans, and they'll just look at the nothing around them and they'll stop blaming themselves, which is what really happens here. People say, I didn't make it. We're told we can make it. This is the land of opportunity. I didn't make it. I'm a failure. Mm-hmm. But actually, it's the system that's a failure. And maybe at some point, they'll begin to put it together little by little.
Well, there's hope to that. So but you've been facing misery in all of its many shades. What does that do to you? You go around. Doesn't that make you eternally angry and just sort of the levels of frustration and the level, I mean, that you can't do anything about this.
I'm constantly angry. To me, anger for me is a real positive thing. It's actually something I use. I kind of hurl myself at my work sometimes. I mean, it really pisses me off the things I've seen and how people are treated, and it drives me to do these sorts of projects. So I think people should be angry. That is like the nuclear fuel for this sort of work. But yeah, there are times, like I said, when I was doing the book on the Gaza Strip, where I thought I'd never want to draw another body as long as I live. I just never want to do this sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. I found also what's helped me is I've started to turn to satire.
Well, that's what I was getting at. One result is BAMF. Right?
Yeah, BAMF. I mean, to me, least selling book of all of them. I mean, just complete flop. But
it's really, also so over the top.
It's so over the top. It's not what people expect from me, but absolutely necessary for my own psyche to do something where I could really pour out the excess anger.
Yeah.
And I've learned that it's really important for me to have projects like that, not just the journalism. Stuff where I can be over the top and just really let loose. Because with journalism, there has to be a certain restraint. You know, there's no point. I don't need to yell in journalism. The people can speak for themselves, and a sensitive reader is going to look at that and be shocked. I don't need to tell them to be shocked.
Okay, now I'm going to ask you something. After the attacks on Charlie Hebdo, you did a piece for The Guardian, I think, where you kind of called for restraint and right and
not in freedom of speech. I mean,
you tell me.
Well, the point I wanted to make is, everyone's free to do what they want to do. I absolutely believe in that. But sometimes I'll criticize what you've done, not the ability to do it. You should be allowed to do it. But in a world where we're living with migrants, where we're living with people who've been marginalized, to kick at them doesn't really make sense to me. In a world where we're going to get more migrants with climate change, with these wars going on, they're going to have to learn to live with us, which is a point I tried to make in that piece also. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have to learn to live with them. And I would rather not see spurious sort of attacks on cultures. That to me is really sort of not my, from my own point of view, that's not how satire should be used.
Okay,
they can do what they want, but my satire is like you punch at power, not at powerless people.
Oh, okay. Which is what you do in Bumf.
I think so. Yeah. But I mean, of course, what happened to the Hebdo people is just beyond the pale.
Yeah. Well, so will you continue to do domestic, deal with domestic issues here?
Yeah. I mean, I wanted, I'm sort of coming up with how I'm going to do it, but I'd like to do a story about, Portland, the city I live in,
mm-hmm.
which in the last few years has just become a neoliberal paradise. Developers are snapping up properties, putting up luxury apartments.
I think that's happening everywhere.
It's happening. It's happening everywhere.
City.
But that's why I think it's important to do a story like this, because it reflects what's going on everywhere. So I figure it's my own city. I might as well do the story here. I would like to learn how a city works. I would like to learn how things get approved, how the city council is involved, how the developers get permits to do what they do, and why there seems to be very little public engagement with these things that are going to affect all of us.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've noticed is a lot of my friends just cannot pay rent anymore. Rents are just going up. And it troubles me because, as I was saying, when I was younger living in Portland, rent wasn't that expensive. I could actually learn to do what I was doing. I could develop as a cartoonist. I had the freedom to make the mistakes and to take the time. Now, no one has that freedom in Portland. I don't know how artists can do their work under these conditions. You can't expect someone to pay $2,000 a month and then, you know, spend 10 years getting to the point where they can make a living off their art.
Right.
A proper living.
Unless you're a trust fund kid.
But unless you're a trust fund kid.
Yeah, no.
So there you go. I mean, I'm pissed off about that. It's another angry thing, but I'd like to learn how a city works, actually.
Okay. So what do you think? And when you look at Trump's America right now, where do you think is the root of the inequality? What do you think? Do you think that corporate tax issue is?
Corporate taxes are part of it, but I mean, this has been going on for a long time.
Because it's happening everywhere.
It's happening everywhere.
It's happening in Germany.
It's happening in Britain, where, you know, education used to be nothing and now it's up to £9,000, where they've, you know, privatized the rail service.
But those are all things that did a long time ago. And education in the UK has always been a two-tier system.
It might be a two-tier system, but at least there's something available for free that was actually pretty good standard. I'm not against people with money spending the money the way they want. I've not a problem with that. But a society has to provide for those who can't. There should be a base level that everyone can enjoy.
I think that's where a lot of people disagree. The neoliberal and the libertarians, they all disagree with you big time on that one, right?
Well, fuck them. I'm their enemy. They're my enemy. That's how I look at it. I don't think the world should be the playground.
But they're pulling the strings. The Koch brothers, this whole.
They are pulling
these super PACs.
They are pulling the strings.
How do we have any chance against that?
Those are questions I'm asking myself. It's not a question of having all the answers for this. I'm trying to learn about this stuff. I'm trying to actually understand. That's why I say I want to understand how a city works. I want to understand how a neoliberal agenda is pushed on a city. That you have to understand it before you can sort of say, is it possible to dismantle this?
Mm-hmm.
I actually got involved in a political campaign where I was to get someone elected to city council whose main issue was rents. Now, whether she is able to do things or not, there's a lot of factors. There are a lot of laws that she can't overcome. There are a lot of people on the council that might not agree with her. So it's a start anyway.
Did she get elected?
She got elected.
All right.
Yeah.
Gee, what do you do for fun?
I have a lot of fun.
Yeah.
To me, drawing is still fun. I listen to music. I have friends.
You listen to music while you draw, right?
Yeah. Listen, I mean, here's the thing. I mean, I'm actually really fulfilled in doing my work. It might be hard on some level, but I think of myself as one of the luckiest people I know. Most people I know have jobs they actually really don't like. Their day-to-day life is not pleasant in the way my day-to-day life is pleasant. As hard as the subject matter is, I'm doing what I want to do. I'm sitting in my on my duff in my bedroom. I count myself really lucky.
Right. Yeah, you are.
Yeah. So
you get away with your own stuff.
I get to do what I want to do. And if I'm looking at these subjects which you say are miserable and they are miserable, it's a choice. Right. Yeah. And I feel like I want to. I'm compelled to do it.
Okay.
All right.
That's wow. That's good. Well, keep up the good work.
Thank you very much.
That's all I can say.
Thank you very much. Rock on.
Interesting. Thanks so much, Joe.
My pleasure, Christoph.
It was good to, we've caught on an hour.
Perfect.
Right. That's good. Well, thanks so much. That was a good look inside your twisted mind.
Okay. It worked okay.
Joe Sacco. What an interesting, well-read, smart dude. I love him. Obviously we've known each other for a long time, but, this talk just really reminded me what a genius he is. And he's a funny guy too. One of the funniest people I've ever met, despite all of this hard work in kind of miserable situations like wars or those wastelands that have been left behind by neoliberalism and turbo capitalism. Anyways, so he'll keep doing interesting things, which I'm excited to read. I look forward to his next book. In the meantime, you should go out and buy some of his great books. They are all available everywhere. I think But I Like It is kind of hard to find, but you can get it probably on eBay or something like that. Each and every single one of them are great books. So thanks for listening. Thanks for tuning in. That was Joe Sacco. My name is Christoph Ellinghaus, and I am going to sign out.